This is special programming from North State Public Radio. I'm Tess Vigeland. Tonight on After Paradise, it's been 33 days since the campfire started. The death toll from the fire remains at 85, but the number of missing now stands at 3. Tonight we hear the latest on the staggering financial cost of the recovery effort, plus an update on what PG&E is doing to change its safety inspection program for transmission lines. And we'll talk with a social worker from the Butte County Behavioral Health Department about how to help children through the trauma of surviving a disaster that's taken their homes, their schools, and their sense of safety in the world. We want to hear your questions and comments. Leave a message for us at 433-4887 or on our website, mynspr.org. For Tuesday, December 11th, 2018, this is After Paradise. Lots of news today out of a briefing held by officials from the government's Office of Emergency Services, Cal OES, and FEMA. So we're going to take it a batch at a time. First, the price tag for the cleanup of the three massive fires that hit the state last month, both here in Butte County and in Southern California, which together destroyed some 19,000 homes and businesses. Mark Ghilarducci is the director of Cal OES.
The cost, how we deal with this will be a combination of funding between the state and the federal government, and to be able to address the overall cost. There is a cost share that exists between the state, local, and federal government. The overall cost of this is a little speculative at this point, but we believe it will be probably in the neighborhood of about $3 billion or so. That could be a little bit more in the end. It depends on how effective and efficient things are.
And practice your patience, because it's going to be a long haul to reconstruction.
I think it's safe to say that it'll take a better part of 1 year to accomplish the majority of the work that we have in front of us. And in Paradise, the challenge, of course, is that you've got limited roadways in and out, and the community itself has small roads, and you can only get so many resources safely into an area and in and out that we can. And that'll all be coordinated very carefully.
Next up was Bob Fenton, regional administrator for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, who issued a plea for available properties throughout Butte County that could house FEMA trailers.
We're looking at any one day, over 30 or 40 options in the Butte area. If there's owners of commercial sites or RV pads or vacant condominiums or other residential properties that I believe would be suitable and available to wildfire survivors. And really, we're looking for facilities that already have pre-existing utilities. So if there are options out there that we're not already looking at, please bring those to our attention.
Fenton says FEMA is looking at two sites right now to create 100-unit mobile home parks. Once those sites are approved, it's about 60 days to getting people into those homes. Meantime, the California Department of Social Services announced a new program this week that provides food assistance to survivors of the campfire. NSPR's Sarah Bohannon has more.
Known as Disaster CalFresh, this emergency food assistance will be available for people who worked or lived in Butte County the day the campfire started and who are not already receiving CalFresh. You could be eligible if you experienced any of the following: a disaster-related expense, a disruption in income, damage to a home or self-employment property, or food loss as a result of the fire or a related power outage. The application period for Disaster CalFresh is only 7 days long over two windows of time. The first window opens tomorrow and goes through Friday. The second starts next Monday, December 17th, and runs through Thursday, December 20th. Applications must be submitted in person at the Butte County Employment Center offices in Chico or in Oroville. The Chico office is located at 2445 Carmichael Drive. The Oroville office is located at 78 Table Mountain Boulevard. Both are open from 7:30 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon. For more information, including a link to the application form, head to mynspr.org. For NSPR News, I'm Sarah Bohannon.
Disaster victims looking for free legal help have a new place to turn as of today. Local attorneys and the Bar Association are banding together to help with all manner of questions, from insurance to property transfers. Sandy Brooks is dean of Cal Northern Law School here in Chico.
Yeah, so what they can anticipate is being able to sit down one-on-one with an attorney that hopefully will be able to answer their questions relative to probate issues, real property transfers, things along those lines. So hopefully they will be able to have their insurance questions answered. If they're not able to meet with an attorney at the time they come in, there is a lot of available resources for them. We've got some great information on other workshops that are being offered from other insurance companies. There's a couple of great opportunities coming up, one on Tuesday, December 18th from 6 to 8 at Chico State that's being offered by the United Policyholders. And they are a nonprofit organization that's mostly an advocacy and education organization. And they're offering a workshop on how to navigate and recover your insurance claim.
What are some of the primary questions that you're finding fire victims have at this point in the process?
Most often they just need to navigate their insurance claim or their insurance policy. They're not sure what their insurance covers. They want to make sure they're understanding what their benefits will be, how to best ask the questions that's going to get them the most from their coverage. So it's just a matter of maybe looking through their policy and determining what kind of coverage they have. Other are property transfer questions. You know, say somebody's decided they may not want to go back up to Paradise and rebuild, but they have a piece of property and they want to know what they can do with it. You know, can they gift it to a family member? Things along those lines.
What should people be looking out for when they are seeking the advice of an attorney? Obviously, there are good players and not so good players. What would you advise people to be on the watch out for?
Well, with regards to any of the insurance claims, they just want to make sure that they're talking with somebody that has some understanding in that area. Now, as far as other claims, they want to make sure they understand who their attorney is, what that attorney can do for them. They want to make sure they can check the track record of that attorney, get multiple recommendations from other attorneys in the area. They want to make sure they meet with attorneys that have a track record for whatever it is they're looking to get information on. So most often they just need to make sure that they're getting good advice from good sound attorneys.
All right. And Sandy, remind us where people can find these free legal clinics.
Yes, we are going to be at the DRC, the Disaster Relief Center, out at the Sears Building, Tuesdays from 4 to 6 and Saturdays from 10 to 2. And then we also have a location at the Family Recovery Center, which is at Walgreens on East Avenue in the Esplanade. And that is geared specifically for folks that have lost family members. And it's a private place where they can meet with one-on-one attorneys to deal with those issues that they may be facing. And then we also have an opportunity on this coming Saturday from 10 to 12 for those individuals to come in and listen to a panel of probate attorneys talk about what they may be encountering.
Sandy Brooks is Dean and President of the Cal Northern School of Law here in Chico. Sandy, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Campfire victims filed two new lawsuits against Pacific Gas and Electric today, alleging that the company ran false or misleading advertisements about the safety procedures used in maintaining power lines. The suits come a day after PG&E announced yet another round of safety measures in the aftermath of the disaster. Dale Kessler is following the story for the Sacramento Bee. Dale, what are they promising?
Well, it's a series of things. They're promising that they're going to do much more detailed safety inspections of transmission lines. They already do routine maintenance and inspections. They say that they're going to be doing a lot more using aerial imagery to complement or to go beyond just the usual visual inspections. They also say that they're going to do a lot more with trimming trees and limbs that are in the vicinity of power lines, and they're going to expand their network of weather stations. They have little weather stations all around the state, and they say they're going to add 1,300 more stations over the next 4 years.
Now, this is on the heels of another wildfire safety program from earlier this year. What did that program involve?
Well, that did a lot of the same things, more weather stations, more real-time weather monitoring, most notably the preventive blackout program, where they would go in and actually shut off power to people across a broad swath of territory if they felt like the fire risk was very high, you know, middle of the summer, very dry, very windy, that sort of thing. They did impose a blackout over about 60,000 customers in October across Northern California. They got a lot of pushback on that. People were grumbling, well, it wasn't necessary. You didn't need to do this. My food spoiled, all that sort of thing. They were going to do another shutdown in areas, including Butte County, in early November, right around the time that the fire started, and at the last minute, they canceled that shutoff. It remains to be seen. We don't really know if they had gone ahead with this power blackout, if it would have prevented the campfire or not. The cause is still under investigation. But clearly, PG&E, they're under a lot of scrutiny, a lot of criticism, a whole bunch of lawsuits, and they're trying to get ahead of this as best they can.
Dale, what are the current investigations underway from the California Public Utility Commission?
There's the PUC doing a wide-ranging investigation into corporate practices, corporate culture, that sort of thing, at PG&E for the last few years. And just the other day, the PUC announced it was going to broaden that investigation to look into wildfire protection. The PUC is not convinced that the utility places enough emphasis on safety, that it's really ingrained in the company's corporate culture like the PUC thinks it should. And on a parallel track, you have the Cal Fire investigation into what exactly happened with the campfire. As I'm sure your listeners know, there's a lot of scrutiny on that one transmission tower that experienced a problem over in Pulga a few minutes before the fire started. And this is about, you know, this is right about where the fire started. There's a lot of suspicion that's been alleged in lawsuits and so forth that the a transmission line clanged into the tower somehow. It sparked, it fell to the ground, and that's what caused the fire.
Dale, obviously PG&E has thousands of trucks currently going around Paradise trying to fix the lines and the poles. What else, if anything, is the company doing to help the city recover?
They appointed their vice president of electric operations into the new title of Chief Rebuilding Officer. And he's going to work with the local community leaders and so on. I think you may see some money thrown around. They say they're going to work with the community on charity efforts. I mean, they made a great point over the last few weeks of saying we have 4,000 workers working practically 24/7 to restore power and to, you know, to clear out the power lines that fell on the ground and so on and so forth. Now they seem to be going this extra step to try and make good with the community, if you will. They realize they've got a terrible public relations problem on their hands. A week or so ago, somebody had been arrested for threatening some of the PG&E line workers. PG&E is, in the minds of some people up there, obviously, is public enemy number one.
Dale Kassler is with the Sacramento Bee, and we've been talking with him about the latest on PGE's role in the campfire. Dale, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And a correction to our story yesterday on the Environmental Protection Agency's cleanup of burned-out properties. We said the agency was going in ahead of residents. EPA, however, is only going on to properties where evacuation orders have been lifted and residents have been allowed back. You are listening to After Paradise, a special program from North State Public Radio. We'll have more just ahead. This is After Paradise, a special program on the aftermath of the campfire from North State Public Radio. I'm Tess Vigeland. Even though these massive wildfires have become common in California, they're still taking many citizens by surprise, and they're becoming more deadly. The Tubbs Fire, 22 killed. The Carr Fire, 8 killed, including 3 firefighters. And the Camp Fire, current death toll 85. And yet some people still refuse to evacuate. Capital Public Radio's Ezra David Romero reports on a few who stayed behind in Paradise and survived.
As the campfire raged towards Kathy and Doug Houston's property on a ridge south of Paradise, they began dousing their two-story house with water.
It puts out a great big stream. There we go.
Embers landed in trees like little bombs, and they drenched them with hoses connected to pumps that pulled water from their pool. This fight lasted for more than 12 hours.
It was really emotional all morning because I would say about every 2 minutes I'd hear an explosion.
Doug and Kathy were prepared. For 2 decades, they actively cleared their property of anything flammable. The couple spent thousands on mowing equipment, water pumps, and industrial hoses. They even bought 45 acres north of their home as a buffer for added safety.
We knew when we moved out here, this would be our responsibility to protect ourselves, to protect our home.
It was the best refinance we ever did to buy land next to us.
This is fire prep to the extreme, and it worked, but it's expensive and time-consuming. That's perhaps one reason why so many residents didn't do the same. CAL FIRE Chief Amy Head recently flew over Paradise and says she could tell who was ready.
Home after home was gone, it was pretty evident that there wasn't a lot of space around these homes to be able to survive a wildfire.
She says preparations begin by creating defensible space. That's clearing at least 100 feet around a home of things that can burn. This includes making sure neighbors do the same and upgrading things like roofs, vents, and windows so embers can't get in. This even means not having decorative plants or chairs within 5 feet of a home. Earlier this year, UC System Forest Advisor Jana Velikovic toured the Carr Fire burn area in Redding.
What surprised me there was how many of the stucco homes were lost, and they were surrounded by green lawn. What the mechanism of entry was is that they had a ring of vegetation right around the outside of their house.
Susie Coker often visits the Angora Fire burn site. That blaze more than a decade ago destroyed about 250 homes in Lake Tahoe.
There's still a lot of flammable plants planted right under picture windows. People have set themselves up for future fires, perhaps in the mistaken belief that they're kind of safe now because there's no big trees.
She's a forest advisor with the UC system and says if you can't evacuate, the best place to be is inside your home or an open area like a ball field. She reiterates, this is a last resort. All this isn't just important for people who live in the woods. The same day the campfire broke out, a brush fire ignited near UC Davis. Nathan Trowernick is the fire chief there.
It experienced the same effects of a wind-driven fire that we're seeing up there. 40-mile-per-hour wind gusts drove the fire over a roadway into dry vegetation.
If it wasn't for a field of dirt blocking the fire, a whole department on campus could have burned.
If you are watching the news and they're talking about a fire near your area, you really need to stop what you're doing and figure out if it's serious enough for you to take action.
Back in the Paradise area, Doug and Kathy are taking care of their neighbor's pets.
Lots and lots of animals.
After watching homes burn, they're left with survivor's guilt.
I have my house, but it's so gut-wrenching to see your town gone and to hear so many people leaving.
And even though her house is standing, she says there is reason enough to cry. In Sacramento, I'm Ezra David Romero.
The psychological effects of this calamity will stay with the community for years to come. We've talked in previous programs about how to cope with the grieving cycle and with the haunting memories of running from the fire. And there are plenty of resources for adults to consult as they make their way through the fog of post-disaster life. But perhaps even more urgently, kids are processing all of those same worries, and it's at least as bad, if not more so, for them because they haven't cultivated a lifetime of coping mechanisms. So today we're going to talk about how to help your kids in the aftermath of disaster. I'm joined by Scott Canelli, a licensed clinical social worker with the Butte County Department of Behavioral Health. Scott Canelli, thank you for coming in.
You're welcome.
What are the major issues that you're currently finding, specifically with children whose families have survived the campfire?
With any disaster, we're finding kids have different reactions to the disaster. A lot of behavioral changes, emotional changes, things that parents need to pay attention to in their kids following a disaster to make sure that they're doing okay. After a disaster, a lot of kids have normal reactions that are behaviors that change. They can become more withdrawn. They can regress into more developmentally younger behaviors. They sometimes don't want to talk to people. Sometimes they can become more aggressive, things like that. And while those things and talking about the trauma or not wanting to talk about traumatic events are normal reactions, we want to make sure that parents are paying attention to their kids to make sure that isn't a long-standing issue. Most kids cope with trauma in different ways. They can play it out, use their dolls, their Barbies, their action figures, or do some kind of play out in the community, and that's okay. We're wanting to make sure that parents aren't over-pathologizing that and saying, oh, there's something wrong with my child. All my son can talk about is, you know, rescuing people out of the fire. Or my daughter is only playing, you know, the house is burning down, things like that.
So that's normal?
That's normal. A lot of kids process things differently through play, and that is normal. But it's important that parents are available to talk to their kids and to make themselves available and be supportive and comforting and have regular routines and rituals as best they can to help kids feel safe.
What are some of the best ways for parents to be there? I suppose a lot of it depends on the age of the child, but let's start with very young children. For parents who have not had to deal with this specific issue post-disaster, what should they be asking? What should they be doing?
So for parents of little kids, the 0 to 5 population, a lot of time with those kids, spending more time than they normally would, a lot of cuddle time, one-on-one time or family time, getting down to their level, talking to them, reassuring them that they're okay and that they're going to make sure that they're safe, allowing their kids to regress a little bit. Some of these kids will start sucking their thumb or bedwetting or having nightmares, things like that. And that's normal after a disaster or a traumatic event. Making sure that they let their kids express themselves but don't push them too hard. So some kids, we talked a little bit earlier, express through play. Others draw. They might be drawing pictures of things that are disturbing to the parents, not being too reactive to the kids.
Hmm.
And maintaining as many regular routines like bedtime and waking up time and taking kids to school as possible. Well, 0 to 5 aren't going to school, but going to events and things like that.
And how about for kids who are, say, between 5 and their teenage years?
So some of the behavior changes in, say, 6 to 10-year-olds, you may have a fear of going to school. They might stop spending time with their friends, withdraw more, have trouble sleeping, be more aggressive or anxious than usual. And making sure that those kids get a lot of attention from the parents, listen to them, ask them what their concerns are, fears are, provide reassurance to them. Sometimes kids have very extreme reactions or responses and believe that bad things are going to happen. And providing some correction and reassurance that no mom and dad or caretaker is really there to help you out. Encouraging some kids, too, to get active and join. There's been kids who are doing toy drives or donation drives or let's make cookies for the firefighters. And that's actually a really positive thing, too, to help kids feel like they're participating and helping change things in a positive way. And also making sure that you continue to celebrate any birthdays, anniversaries, things that are normal, showing that the fire, the disaster is not changed everything, that you're going to be going back to a sense of normalcy as soon as possible.
You know, you mentioned giving the kids a lot of attention, and I would imagine for the parents that this would actually be a very difficult time to be mm-hmm. providing that attention.
Right.
Because there's so much that they're having to deal with outside of their children, a roof over their heads. Any advice for parents on how to make sure that your kids are getting enough from you?
A good question. Parents need to take care of themselves. If they're not healthy, it's hard for them to be attentive to their kids and to provide whatever emotional and physical needs or support the kids need. If the parents don't have someone to talk to, that would be the first recommendation. Find someone to talk to. It doesn't have to necessarily be a mental health professional. It can be a friend, a peer, someone who's gone through things, significant other. but you need to have some place to express yourself and to get support. Modeling healthy behaviors is also important too. So if you used to work out or go for walks in the park, continue to do that, reconnect and do those things. Make sure as parents that you get good sleep. Have as many of the usual rituals that you had before. There are concerns sometimes where parents and sometimes some of the teenagers start resorting to drugs or alcohol to numb or to escape. And kids can see that. Mommy's drinking another glass of wine, another bottle of wine, and that's unusual. You want to make sure that you're not modeling unhealthy behaviors for the kids. But both kids and parents, while having reactions after a fire that can be concerning, also sometimes if it doesn't improve, can sometimes need a higher level of support. Hmm. So it's okay to ask for help at any time.
Let's move on to the teenagers who, perhaps are most aware at their age of what has happened and the reality of their situation. What are some of the things to watch out for with them? You mentioned drug and alcohol abuse starting. Mm-hmm. What are some other issues that they could be facing?
So teens are pretty challenging as it is because they have a lot of behavior changes, and we often get parents asking us about things that are pretty normal about teenagers, but they're concerning because they change sleep patterns, communication patterns. Some kids will withdraw and not want to talk. Parents can sometimes ask teens, are you okay? Do you want to talk? Oh, no, I'm fine. Everything's okay. And while they might not be talking to the parent, if they're talking to someone, that's good. It doesn't necessarily have to be the parent. It could be their peers. Teens will also go on media, mass media, or social media, and communicate, which is a double-edged sword because it can be very supportive. But also the concern is they have direct access to videos and feeds of the fire and the crisis that can actually re-traumatize or make their stress even worse. And we've seen not just teens but kids and parents who've been watching the fires on TV and pictures of burning buildings behind them, and you can just see them start to hyperventilate and become more stressed. So I would encourage not just teens but everyone to limit the amount of internet or TV time they get of the disaster, because that we've seen can actually make things worse. Teens, while they might say everything's fine, might develop also some what we call somatic symptoms or physical symptoms. They might have stomach aches or headaches or unknown causes for pain. And sometimes that is a normal response to stress where people feel like they can't talk about it, but their body kind of develops physical symptoms to the stress. So being aware of that, making sure that they're healthy, and if they have medical issues that need to be checked out, sometimes just going and seeing a medical professional can be helpful too.
I know that you have counselors at the FEMA Disaster Recovery Center.
Yes.
Where else can people find you?
We also will have counseling support services at the Silver Dollar Fairground.
Okay.
We also have counselors providing services in all the schools. So if there are kids in schools that don't want to come through our front doors for services and need the help from us, we have both county employees and contracted employees that serve the youth throughout Butte County.
And you have a crisis line, don't you?
Yes. Butte County Behavioral Health operates a crisis service line 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They can call 530-891-2810.
Scott Canelli, Assistant Director for Butte County Behavioral Health, thank you for coming in.
You're welcome.
And that is our program for Tuesday, December 11th, 2013, 33 days since the fire started. We are produced by Sarah Bohannon, Mark Albert, and Phil Wilkie. Adam Ragusea composed our theme music. Special thanks today to Matt Fidler. Tomorrow, a special edition featuring survivors of the Tubbs Fire in Sonoma County. They share their stories and how they've gotten through the past year. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is After Paradise from North State Public Radio.